It's another edition of Political Rewind for the start of a new week. Welcome to all of you out there. I'm Bill Nigut. Jim Galloway on this Monday afternoon is with me, as he is on most Mondays and Fridays. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, of course. And you read his column in the newspaper on Wednesdays and Sundays. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Hey, Jim.
How you doing today?
I'm great. I'm very relieved we finally have a location, a venue. I've been so worried about where the Democrats would put their debate.
No, it's not official yet. No, it's not official
well,
yet.
Well, I guess, okay, well, we'll get to it in a couple minutes. But first, let me introduce the others in our studio with us. And by the way, you can see them if you join us on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB news page on Facebook Live. Or, as Tom Faust has been mentioning to me, you can also listen to us on every social media. I mean, there's so many platforms. Our website, our podcast, you can listen to it everywhere you want. Isn't that great, Melita Easters?
I think it's wonderful.
Melita Easters is the founder and the director of the Georgia Win List, which is an organization, you've heard me say it before, that recruits Democratic women who are pro-choice to run for office.
It's a great pleasure to be with you again.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And we're also glad to have former State Representative Edward Lindsay. Used to represent Atlanta in the state house, finally gave up the elective politics to become a partner now at Denton's, Ed, the world's largest law firm.
That's correct.
You spent the weekend on St. Simon's.
I did. I went down for a beautiful wedding. For those of you who do listen in on the lot, sometimes you've heard of Emma Hurt, who works at with public radio.
Over down the street from you.
Yeah,
she's terrific.
She got married to a very fine young man who's one of the closest friends of my twins.
Well, we like people down the street, so we give a hearty congratulations to Emma and her new husband. All right, let's get right to it. Jim, all this speculation, which we have said on the show several times, mattered to virtually no one except political junkies or people like us who have to cover these things. They finally decided, no, we're not going to go to the 6th or 7th district. We're going to put this debate in the heart of Atlanta. I think a pretty interesting choice. Tyler Perry's new studio complex, 300-plus acres down where Fort McPherson used to be.
Right, right. 6 miles south of downtown.
Yeah, yeah.
Very close to the airport.
It strikes me that there are really good stories that can come out of this for Democrats if you are simply playing to your base. An African-American entrepreneur who's had tremendous success, right?
Right.
You're talking about somebody who's redeveloped a part of Atlanta that he hopes will grow commercially around him. I mean, there are all sorts of good stories you can tell when you're playing to your base.
Right, right. You know, and one of the more subtler parts of that is, you know, there was some immediate pushback on the Republican side that said, "Oh, Democrats are going Hollywood." But not exactly. Not really. Because this is. I mean, this is. Tyler Perry is very much not Hollywood.
Yeah.
He is kind of. He's a Southerner of his own shtick here.
Yeah.
And it's. I would also point out that this is on a very large private property complex. And that does keep protesters and that's a lot of acreage that will be under private control.
The word is that I want to start by saying I don't know how much truth there is to this, but we were all kind of had it told it to us in the ether out there that the Democrats were leaning towards going up to Rusty Paul, Mayor Rusty Paul's Sandy Springs facility, City Springs, which is a beautiful new cultural arts center that Keisha Bottoms particularly fought fiercely to get this thing in the city of Atlanta. That's the story we're all hearing.
Yeah, and I think it's starting to come out. I mean, I think what you had was maybe DNC, maybe some Washington support for a sixth district location, knowing that Lucy McBath is running for that all important first reelect.
Yeah, Yeah. Edward, what did you think when you heard about that?
Well, I thought it was a win-win for just about everybody. The fact of the matter is that it's a big win for Mayor Bottoms, who gets to trumpet economic development on the south side of Atlanta. It was a win for Republicans because they could trumpet the fact that they're going to a facility that would not have existed but for economic development and tax laws that were changed in 2007 that promoted the entertainment industry to come into Georgia, in which it's now grown from about $350 million a year impact in Georgia to a $9.5 billion a year impact in Georgia. So it was a win for them. And quite frankly, it probably is a little bit of a win for Lucy McBath, because the way that some of these debates have gone in terms of tilting to the left, Lucy McBath is running in a moderate district, swing district, and I'm not so sure if she really wanted to have 20 or so Democrats up there trumpeting to see how far they could go to the left.
Well, the other big win for Lucy McBath is not having to bother with all of the people who would have wanted her to get them tickets if that's in her backyard.
I think that may even be the biggest win of all.
But the other thing that this location does is gives the Democrats a big nod to the most loyal, largest base of their voters, African-American women, the women who fueled Tyler Perry's film empire by going to every single one of the Madea movies.
All of the Madea, which we just learned. I didn't know this. Jim, you were surprised as I was. A couple minutes before the show, Melita, you made that point. Oh, this is for the Madea audience. And so I pulled up a trailer or an interview with Tyler Perry, and we all heard very briefly them talk about 11 Madea pictures. I had no idea
It's a strong franchise, and those women love him and how much he's made them laugh over the years. And I think showcasing the empire he's built will be a loyalty builder for them.
Yeah.
I think, Jim, another thing that's going to be, look, I mean, we know we're going to see stories ahead of time, TV stories that are going to be written about in the national newspapers as well, about the Tyler Perry facility. He's now got 12 sound stages there. So it's also going to be a boon for the Georgia film industry. This is a place to come and make movies, not just at Tyler Perry's, but if you can't book his studio, we've got all these other incredible facilities as well. But there's also something kind of lovely about the Tyler Perry facility. He pointed out when he built his 12 sound stages that nowhere else were there sound stages. Typically, the studios name their sound stages after stars. And he says, and I don't know this to be a fact, but I assume he knows what he's talking about, that nowhere else are sound stages named after great African-Americans in the film business. So there's a Diane Carroll. There's a Denzel Washington sound stage. Those are the sort of little tidbits.
Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Yes. Even some of the Hollywood establishment who had earlier criticized him in his career, Spike Lee still got a stage named after him.
And these are the kind of little tidbits, as you well know, Galloway, that reporters, when they're doing color stories about a location, a venue, love to pick up on.
Oh, sure. And this is, I mean, you have to know that the guy is going to be giving tours of the place from here until November 20th.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So,
well, and he has such a humble, gracious demeanor about him when he's being interviewed that I think will appeal to a lot of people in those stories and during those tours.
All right. So, Melita, let me turn to you first, and then you're certainly welcome to weigh in on this too, Ed. Ed Lindsay just said, Lucy McBath maybe didn't want all those liberals in, up there near her stomping grounds up there in the 6th District. But does venue really matter one way or another at all? I mean, Lucy McBath is still going to be painted as an out-of-touch liberal radical by the Republicans, no matter where the debate is. But, so two questions. One, did Democrats miss an opportunity to maybe expand their base a little bit up in the suburbs, whether it's 6th or 7th District, or could the location matter less?
I think the location matters depending upon the spin you give it. And in that instance, the Tyler Perry Studios is far more spinnable than City Springs would have been. And I think that Lucy McBath will be perfectly capable of carving out her own identity. I was at a couple of events over the weekend where there were a lot of grassroots women who had campaigned for Lucy McBath's first election, and they are still very loyal to her. They are very thrilled that she's running for Congress again and not toying with a Senate bid, and they are ready to get out and knock on doors just as they did before.
The other part, Bart, Bill, is look how this fits into Stacey Abrams's vision of what Georgia will be politically over the next decade, where you start to pay more attention, and to the African American base, and it comes to its own not just in terms of power, but also in terms of a financial heft.
Well,
go ahead, Molly.
Well, I was going to say what Jim was just saying. Stacey Abrams, in her speech at the Democratic dinner, talked about the fact that more African-American voters voted for her in 2018 than had voted total in 2014. And she talked about the Latinx and Asian-American voters more than doubling, the youth vote increasing by 139%. And then on Friday afternoon, even after your show had already closed, you had the announcement of 510,000 new voters just in the last 10 months. And so attracting the messaging that attracts these youthful voters, these new voters, is very consistent with the hip, exciting film industry.
Right. We're going to have plenty of time to talk about this in the weeks ahead, but Edward, you wanted to get a last word in on this?
You know, like I said earlier, I think it was a smart move, I think, for a lot of different reasons. Does it really make a difference in terms of attracting folks who might not otherwise vote for Democrats to think about voting for Democrats? No. But for all the reasons we've already expressed on the stories leading up to it, there's something in there for everyone to trump it.
Jim, a friend of ours who runs a film studio here in Atlanta is listening to the show, and he just sent a text to me that may be worth one more mention about the Tyler Perry choice. The choice of Tyler Perry Studios might also explain why Tyler Perry recently came out against the heartbeat bill after pretty much total silence. We were all glad that happened. That's interesting. I wasn't aware of that, but certainly the other studio folks would know that.
Yeah, studio folks would know that. Most other studio folks have been decidedly neutral on this. It may be changing now that it's in federal court.
I hadn't even thought about the implications of that this does suddenly, Melita, you're nodding vigorously, maybe raise, you know, will other film studio heads will be asked about this now, too, here in Georgia, I would think.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Let's do this. As I said, we'll have plenty of time in the weeks ahead. That debate's on November 20th. We'll learn more and more as we move forward about the plans for the studio, how they're going to set it up and all that sort of thing. And we'll get to that as we continue to move toward the debate. Let's talk a little bit about the impeachment process, especially as it relates to Georgia. Just one headline, Charles Kupperman, who was the deputy to former National Security Advisor John Bolton, had been subpoenaed to testify today before the three committees that are doing this inquiry. He, as you probably know by now, he has gone to court and said that he feels there are contrary pulls involved in this. He feels that perhaps the executive branch has a right to exert executive privilege and prevent him from testifying, but he also recognizes that Congress has a right to investigate. So he's asked a court, basically, Jim, to sort this out. He's passed the ball off to them.
Yeah. I don't know whether this is a delaying tactic that he's doing on behalf of the Trump administration, but it actually gives the courts an interesting entree. Of course, last week there was a ruling that you had a district level federal judge say that that the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry was entirely legitimate.
Edward?
Well, I think it's a sign he has a smart lawyer. You don't necessarily want to ignore the edicts of your boss, and he still works within the White House. And you also don't want to ignore a subpoena.
Yeah.
And so he's got a lawyer who said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to take this to court and put it in their hands and say, hey, do I honor this subpoena or do I honor the order from my boss? I think, hats off to his lawyer.
I think it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I understand, Melita, that Democrats want to get him in there. I mean, he obviously would have a lot of information, having worked so closely with John Bolton. But it's a smart lawyer.
Yeah.
But again, as Jim says, give the court, another court, a chance to weigh in on all
of
this.
Well, but then what happens if it goes up for an immediate appeal to the Supreme Court when Chief Justice Roberts is to preside over a Senate trial? Is there a necessity for a recusal for Roberts not to decide about who can be called by the House if he is later to preside in the Senate? I don't know about
that. Well, I will say this. It depends on whether or not the trial judge, let's assume that he's going to rule that the gentleman should testify. It's up to the trial judge to determine whether or not this is something that he will stay his order or not.
So
he may very well, order him to go testify and not stay his decision, which would compel him to go ahead and testify.
House Democrats, for the first time, have publicly said they're threatening to charge Kupperman with contempt if he doesn't appear. The only reason I think they would be suddenly looking at this with Kupperman is he's kind of a stalking horse for Bolton himself, right, Jim? That's the guy they really want to get to, and we don't know what's going to happen there.
But this also sort of sets it up in terms of determining, for that matter, whether or not Bolton should testify. So let's go ahead and get it in front of a judge.
Right.
Let that judge decide whether or not they can be compelled to testify, and let's move on from this particular issue.
All right. Getting back to Georgia and impeachment, our own Buddy Carter made an appearance on Saturday Night Live Saturday night. I know you probably didn't see this segment, Jim, because by then you're way past your bedtime.
Oh, no, I watched those on Sunday morning on YouTube.
Okay. a Weekend Update. Did a little feature about the Republicans who came down and stormed the SCIF, the secured room in which the investigation is unfolding. And they showed a clip of Buddy Carter at the microphones outside the SCIF and had some comic Colin Jost. You'll hear this unfold starting with Colin Jost.
A group of House Republicans led by live-action quagmire Matt Gaetz stormed into a hearing room during testimony in the impeachment inquiry, and these Republicans were not happy with how Trump is being treated.
If a government can do this to the President of the United States, they can do it to you as well. You need to be scared. You need to be very scared.
Yes, somehow I'm not scared. I just don't think that the average American is scared that they're going to lose their job for withholding military aid for Ukraine. This protest was so lame that halfway through, the Republicans ordered a pizza.
Edward, we now have had a few days to think about what happened with that, but I'm not sure that the Republicans who stormed the SCIF really did themselves any favors, did they?
Well, this was political theater. Somewhat similar to the political theater we saw a couple of years ago when the Dems held a sit-in on the House floor over gun control. But it does sort of go to a more serious issue, which is whether or not the process that's going forward in the House is an open process in which the American people can witness and help make an informed decision. And as a lawyer, I think process is important. I mean, I've been a little bit surprised by some in the media who don't seem to be taking the process issue that seriously. This is an impeachment of a president of the United States who was duly elected. If you're going to remove them from office, shouldn't you be having a more open process in which you're bringing in witnesses? Both sides can witness them. For that matter, both sides can bring in witnesses and help the American people decide whether or not this is a smart thing to do. The charges against the president are very serious. I've said so on this show on multiple occasions, and some of the things that he has done I very much disagree with. But I do believe that beneath, or rather behind the theater that we're seeing, there's some serious questions as to whether or not the Democrats who are controlling the House need to open up the process and let the American people see for themselves what these folks are testifying to. Because right now we have, after everyone testifies, we have folks on one side coming out and saying one thing and folks on the other side coming out and saying another. And underneath the present rules that have been laid down by the chair of the committee, neither side are permitted to actually go into detail as to what has been testified
Melita, to. Melita, the Democrats do have to fight off optics that are not in their favor right now. They will open the hearings up. We know that Republicans in the majority have held hearings behind closed doors. But we're not dealing with what happened before. We're dealing with what's happening right now.
Well, the Democrats are operating under rules set up by the Republicans when they were in charge, number one. Number two, this publicity stunt is different from the sit-in on the floor of the House, because this publicity stunt breached protocols for a secure space and broke rules for that secure space. And so those Republicans thumbed their nose at protocols that are supposed to be respected. And so that was part of what made their behavior so reprehensible. And in some ways, it mirrors the president's own behavior this weekend when he told Russia about the military operation and refused to follow the protocols of interaction between the president and Congress by not letting the Big Eight know that operation was taking place.
Yeah, we know that he didn't.
But let me sort of address
very quickly, because I really don't want to go down this rabbit hole for too long.
We heard, and quite frankly, when the Democrat in Congress held a sit-in, that they were also breaching protocols to how the House is supposed to operate. Number two is that the Democratic leadership is doing this impeachment very different from how Republicans did the impeachment inquiry into Clinton in 1998, the Democrats did the impeachment of President Nixon in 1973-74.
Right, here's where I have to jump in on a fact check on this, because we've talked about this on the show. The Nixon impeachment and the Clinton impeachment followed special prosecutors who had already gathered facts, had built their cases that were then taken to the committees, the judiciary committees, whatever. In this case, there was no special prosecutor. They are gathering facts now and will then turn to open hearings.
But we have an election only a year away. If we're going to be able to get an impeachment in this year before you start running into an election, they need to move forward with the public as quickly as possible.
I doubt that we're going to reach a trial stage before the end of the year. Yeah, right. But it would not surprise me in the next week to 10 days to see Democrats have at least one or two public hearings.
I think they have to. I've said this on the show.
I think you're right. I think they do have to.
I think that in the long run, they've got to get this to open hearings, because although the numbers on impeachment of the president seem to be growing, we'll see if there's not a problem if they don't start turning to open hearings. All right, I want to get one more item in, because we got some news. Greg Bluestein just sent me a text. Jim Galloway, your colleague, has a really interesting story here. Chris Carr, the Attorney General of Georgia and the former Chief of Staff to Senator Johnny Isaacson, just put out a tweet that Greg saw. Here's the exact language of the tweet from Chris. I support Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senator David Perdue, and Senator Isaacson. The House is setting a bad precedent. Impeachment should only ever be pursued with extreme caution, must follow due process, and must be open and transparent. I I knew he was listening to our show. And by that, I mean Bluestein and Carr. All right, let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more in a minute.
You've been thinking about helping this station with a donation. Why not donate that extra car, truck, or RV you no longer need? It's easy. Pickup is free. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support, and you could even get a tax deduction. Get the process started today. Give us a call to learn more about the advantages of donating a vehicle. And thanks very much for your support.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars.
5 years ago, ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared a new Islamic State in Mosul. Now people there are reacting to news of his death.
The al-Nuri Mosque, where al-Baghdadi declared his caliphate, is mostly destroyed, and the UN has started to rebuild it. But the society that ISIS fractured won't be so easily repaired.
Reaction to the ISIS leader's death from Iraq this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB.
It would throw...
Here we are back on Political Rewind with Melita Easters, Edward Lindsay, and Jim Galloway in the studio with us today. On Friday's show, Jim, we started talking about what is a very prestigious annual survey. It's called the American Values Survey of PRRI, the Public Religious Research Institute, which every year... This is a data-rich study. Tom Faust, I wonder if we can put a link to the PRRI survey up on our social media, because I think people might like to get into it a little bit more. And I promised Friday we didn't have much time that we would do more with it today. So I'm going to throw out some figures to all of you. I know that each of you has had a chance to look at this. But let me just start with this portion of the survey, and let's see what we think about this. This is like, by the way, a survey of 3,000-plus individuals across the country. The survey found that Americans in general believe that the top three issues for 2020 are health care, terrorism, and climate change. But they break that down by party affiliation, which leads them to what the name of their survey is this year, Fractured Nation. And here's why. The survey shows that Democrats say the top issues are health care, climate change, and foreign interference elections, whereas Republicans say that the top issues are terrorism, immigration, and crime. And going into percentages on the radio is very difficult, but there alone, Jim, you see this real divide in terms of what people think are the most important issues for next year.
Oh yeah, we have become a nation separated by algorithms. You know, you are fed what you have seen, and you see what you've been fed. And I wanted to pitch this idea. I think we all need to swap cell phones and let the person across the table use yours for maybe an hour, 2 hours, and call up all those stories that you wouldn't, just to thwart what's happening to us.
Yep.
I actually teach a class along with Mary Margaret Oliver in our parish called Finding Jesus on the Front Page. And that is a requirement in the class, is that you are required to watch or read some news source that has a diametrically opposite view of yours in that week, and come back and talk about it. And I believe as we went through this and looked through this study, it simply confirms what we've already been talking about for a long time, and that so many of us have siloed our news sources. So that conservatives are getting their news source from one entity and liberals from another entity. And driving back and forth across the state of Georgia this week, as I flipped around on my radio, I can tell you right now, the different news sources, left and right, are not talking about the same news story.
So, but Melita, let me throw something in here and then let you respond to what I'm asking, and then whatever other observation you want to make. So I think it's fascinating that Democrats see health care as by far the most important issue in the 2020 election. independents surveyed also say that health care is the number one issue. 64% of them. And climate change is almost as important to independents as it is to Democrats. So with that said, number one, we learned last year in the mid-year elections just how important health care is to winning elections. Independents embrace Democrats who said, you know, pre-existing conditions was the most important issue they were dealing with. Even in the 6th District, Lucy McBath really made it a priority over gun control in many
ways.
Well,
and health care is a big issue. And in parts of rural Georgia, which are ruby red, it is a big issue because there half the counties lack an OBGYN, which leads to people not wanting to continue to live in those rural areas. And you have hospitals which have closed. For example, the Valdosta Hospital right now is not even certified. It's taking in patients, but it's not certified. And that serves a big expanse of counties where the local hospitals have closed. So even in ruby red areas, health care becomes an issue based on local circumstances.
But you don't expect Democrats are suddenly going to make inroads in much of rural Georgia over health care.
Not always over health care, but it tatters, it casts doubts on the Republican office holders who currently are there and let a hospital go without certification or let a hospital locally close.
So it
chips away at their support.
Jim?
What I would, I'd dearly love to see the crosstabs on the crosstabs, especially as it goes by age, because both health care and climate change are very, very much, very generationally driven issues. I mean, I'm coming up on 65. My health care is taken care of.
Yeah.
My children's health care certainly isn't.
Well, newsflash, I was beginning to agree with Melita until the very end.
Well, I always love it when you agree with me.
I know that. But I do agree with you, absolutely, that quality health care in rural areas is at a crisis point, but we've been drifting toward a crisis point for decades. The fact of the matter is you're not going to have economic development unless you've got, three things, and maybe even a fourth or fifth, but three in particular. One is quality health care. Second one is a qualified workforce. And the third one is transportation and in so many of these hospitals. But I will say this, is that Republicans, at least in the General Assembly, have not been ignoring this issue. I mean, there is the Rural Development Council that did push forward some health care issues in the last General Assembly session. And every time that they hold one of their meetings around the state, health care is on the list.
Well, Stephen Fowler, our GPB political reporter, has talked to the governor, who says he's rolling out a big, big rural health care initiative in the next session of the General Assembly. So, I mean, they get what Melita's saying. They're just hoping to keep a hold of the rural areas of the state if they address these matters.
Well, I don't know if you all follow him, but Charlie Hazlett's blog, Trouble in God's Country, does some amazing data dives. I don't have a head for figures the way he does, but some of his conclusions about the disparities in rural Georgia are truly amazing.
I want to dig down just a little bit into some of the crosstabs that are interesting, I think, because, again, this is an organization that looks at religious affiliation and how people of various faiths are feeling about the issues. When you look at the top three critical issues by religious affiliation, white mainline Protestants, black Protestants, Hispanic Protestants, white Catholics, all say that health care is the number one issue in the election. Jim, it is white evangelicals who say terrorism is the top issue and health care isn't even, and immigration is second. Health care falls to third. That's really interesting.
It's interesting. It does tell you, it shows you the kind of the bond that exists between, I think, Donald Trump and white evangelicals. Terrorism is very much of a fear issue. It's an expression of uncertainty, I think.
Well, and some of that feeds into the philosophical underpinning of an evangelical pastor, say, Fire and Brimstone Baptist, whose sermons are more often fear-based and therefore Trumpian in nature, as opposed to, say, an Episcopalian pastor who talks more about love?
Well, sometimes I wonder when I see these numbers, and I kind of wonder whether or not a little more drilling down was necessary if they had broken it down along economic levels, or for that matter, along rural versus suburban versus urban, because I suspect that not all white evangelicals are thinking the same thing. They don't all come from the same area. And sometimes when you hear, well, women think this or evangelicals think this, I go, you need to drill down a little bit farther down to sort of see how that group breaks out in terms of where they go on a particular issue.
Well, and in rural Georgia, I mean, the evangelical, a real small town has Baptist, Methodist, foot washers and snake handlers. And you have to go a few miles to find the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians. So sometimes the rural areas, it's limited by the closeness of which church option you have.
Let's refine our language to say maybe Baptists and Pentecostals.
Yeah. Well, that's right. There's some truth to that. But look, ever since the president's decision to pull out of Syria, and this survey does not reflect that because it was conducted certainly before then, but there have been ever since then some questions as to whether perhaps the president might be losing some of his evangelical support because evangelicals, some of them, see it as an abandonment of a Christian community that needs to be free from persecution, which there are fears will happen there. There are concerns about whether suddenly Iran will have more power in terms of dealing with Israel. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons evangelicals are worried about this, to the extent that Pat Robertson, as you'll all recall, because we played it on the show, and here it comes again, said this about Trump in that decision.
I am absolutely appalled that the United States is going to betray those democratic forces in northern Syria, that we possibly going to allow the Turkish to come in against the Kurds. That Erdogan is a thug. He has taken control of his country as a dictator. He is a strong leader, and to say he's an ally of America is nonsense. He is in for himself. And the president who allowed Khashoggi to be cut in pieces without any repercussions whatsoever is now allowing the Christians and the Kurds to be massacred by the Turks. And I believe, and I want to say this with great solemnity, the president of the United States is in danger of losing the mandate of heaven if he permits this to happen.
Jim, so there's Pat Robertson. Nevertheless, although there are concerns, and who knows whether the raid yesterday will change some of this, there are some cracks appearing in the evangelical support for the president.
Yeah. Let me first. Let me say that the mandate of heaven is a Confucian term, but you kind of catch the guy's drift here.
Yeah.
He is one of the very few who have actually kept up his criticism. I think after he said that, he was looking for a rolled umbrella.
Yeah.
Next to Trump, but other ones like Jerry Falwell,
as in
Jr.
Neville Chamberlain. For yes. Those of you who aren't getting that,
sorry about that.
That's fine.
I got that one.
But Jerry Falwell Jr. is on board. He's very strongly on. I haven't heard from much more from Tony Perkins to see if he of Family Research Council. So it's so far. I think it's holding. I think is it loosening? Yeah, I think it is loosening a little bit.
Edward, I mean, Trump needs a big vote from the evangelical community to win re-election. Everybody seems to agree about that.
Yes,
and certainly here in the South, we're particularly attuned to evangelicals and their political positions on issues, right?
And he needs to focus on those issues that drive the evangelical vote. A lot of times friends of mine who are not in that camp ask, well, how can evangelicals stay with the president despite a lot of his personal foibles, for want of a better word. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of, if you talk to evangelicals, they'll go back to the Old Testament. And they go, well, you know, God chooses a lot of questionable individuals as his emissaries on earth. He chose Jacob, despite stealing his brother's birthright. He chose Moses, despite a murder he committed. He chose David, King David, despite what he did with Bathsheba's husband. He chose Paul, despite the fact that he originally persecuted Christians. So that's where evangelicals fall back upon, in that they're going to focus on what he's doing versus who he is. And if they don't like what he's doing, they could turn on him.
Well, Trump checks a lot of those boxes.
Well, Melita, here's what's interesting. Okay, so again, and this is the last set of numbers, because again, I realize that on the radio, it's hard to do numbers for people without the ability to show you any visuals on this. But asked to describe the strength of their approval for Trump, they say now 81%+ of them support him for reelection, as according to this study. But asked about the strength of their approval, 44% of evangelicals say they do approve now, but those 44%, they claim that Trump could lose their support depending on what happens in the year ahead, as opposed to only 31% who say they are solid for him. Now, that said, 47% of white evangelicals say they're in, period. He can't do anything to change their minds.
Well, this survey was released 10 days ago.
Yeah.
Some of the polling went all the way back to mid-September. There's a lot of water under the Trump bridge since then, in that, the Kurds, abandonment of the Kurdish alliance that we've always had has happened since this survey took place. And there's a lot of stuff that's come out in the House witnesses that have leaked from those proceedings. So I think the further erosion of even these numbers would be demonstrated if you conducted the same poll of same respondents.
All right, we got to get a break in. Edward, do you have a quick comment?
The only thing I'll add to what Melita was saying is that a lot will also depend on who the Democratic nominee is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because in the end, it's a binary choice. And if it's something similar to what we've seen in the past, what we're seeing in these debates, the evangelical community is likely to come home to Trump.
That's a good way to move on, because everything in this survey points to exactly that. The people who were surveyed are all in flux about who they want the Democratic nominee to be and whether they'll support the nominee regardless of who it is. All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back with more on Political Rewind.
I'm Gil Rogers, director of the Georgia and Alabama offices of the Southern Environmental Law Center. The Southern Environmental Law Center is an advocacy organization that uses the power of the law to protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the natural special places here in Georgia. We see it as a natural synergy, being an underwriter of Georgia Public Broadcasting. We see public radio as an important audience.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Prince's biographer, Dan Pipenbring. Shortly before his death, Prince selected Pipenbring to help him write his memoir. The book includes pages Prince had written and left behind about his childhood and adolescence. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org, and you can listen live on the GPB apps, available at your favorite app store.
Jim Galloway, we've only got a few minutes left, but I was really fascinated by the column that you wrote for yesterday, the Sunday Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is still online. People can go to AJC.com and find it. You took on a big national issue, but you found a really interesting local slant on it. And basically, you were addressing Trump's war against what he calls the deep state. And part of it was based on the fact that Susan Rice's book is out.
She was here last week.
And you quote from her. But you also talk about Charles Shapiro, who is a former diplomat and now the president of the World Affairs Council of Atlanta. Just in general, first of all, what was the point you wanted to make in that column so we can talk about it a little?
It goes back to the impeachment inquiry and in that the Democratic case is being made by these State Department workers, Foreign Service officers, pretty much all of them, who have decided not to obey the orders not to show up, and they're responding to the subpoenas, and they are very much establishing this quid pro quo. And what I'm seeing is, and this happened before, this was happening even before last week, but you see this, you see that everybody's talking about the hollowing out of the State Department. And I don't think people quite realize how important that is. That's not deep state. That is infrastructure. That is a series of embassies, all a network that's all across the globe trying to keep us out of trouble. And when you toss aside all this expertise, then the world becomes more dangerous, not less.
Who is Charles Shapiro, and what did you say about what did he tell
he
you?
He was a U.S. He's retired, I think, 11 years. U.S. ambassador to Venezuela was his high point, but he was in on the invasion in Grenada. Back in '83, he showed up in a gray flannel suit there as a diplomat. But he has served for Reagan, he has served for Clinton, he has served for Obama. These people are very, very proud of the fact that they will tell a Republican president the same thing that they tell a Democratic president. And I think it's on par with what's happening with the FBI, I think.
And I think one of the points, Edward, that Jim pointed out in this is that Georgia, like every other state in this country, we need a professional class of diplomats in how we conduct our business overseas.
Well, the fact of the matter is, our import-export needs here in this state clearly demonstrate exactly what Jim's talking about. We are in the process of finishing deepening the Savannah port, which will be a major artery to the world from Georgia for Georgia goods. And so Jim's absolutely right. I would sort of simplify it a bit over what and what Jim's saying is that we need around the world what I call a don't do that guy. Or that don't do that gal. Someone who will tell whoever's in power, honestly, you just can't do that. This is not a good idea.
Need someone in power who will listen to the people who say don't do that.
And I agree with you. And hopefully we will have folks who are elected on either side of the political aisle doing so. And, you know, we have a lot of honorable people, as Jim has pointed out, who are serving around the world, sometimes in very dangerous locations, and serving our needs. And we need to honor them, and we don't need to cast aspersions upon their character just because they may, at one time or the other, be disagreeing with the president.
Melita?
I would broaden Jim's point to say that many of the domestic departments of our government are also losing career people under the Trump administration. Department of Agriculture moved a whole set of offices outside of Washington to the Midwest, knowing that they would not transfer. So the government is losing a whole lot of deep knowledge about how government works across many departments, not just the Department of State.
Jim, it's interesting as we kind of take a turn that Melita gives us a chance to do. She talks about Sonny Perdue, our agriculture secretary and former governor, who did do just that. He took the entire research division
and shipped it to Missouri.
And shipped him off to, knowing they didn't want to go, and one of their concern is the employees who state did not want to be transferred with, that this is all part of the effort to erase sort of the kind of research they were doing on issues that might be important to the agriculture community, but that might not be in the best interest of the Trump administration.
Right, right. There was a one of the former researchers put a op-ed in the Washington Post maybe two weeks ago, basically saying that the two papers that his department had put out had undercut the Trump administration. One was showing the economic beneficial economic impact that food stamps have in certain communities, and the other one was on climate change.
Let me, while we're talking, we've gone back to Trump, and I want to, one last thing, Mr. Lindsay. Having seen the Chris Carr tweet saying he supports McConnell, he supports Isaacson, he supports Perdue, who all signed the non-binding resolution condemning the House's impeachment inquiry, were you at all surprised that Johnny Isaacson signed on to that? Isaacson has been there are two reasons for bringing that up. One, when Trump, when Isaacson released a statement about the raid that the successful raid yesterday, he started by complimenting the men, he by honoring the service men and women who really accomplished that. The Jolt pointed out today that Perdue started by saying Trump deserves credit. I was a little surprised that Isaacson signed on to that resolution, especially since he's leaving in a couple months.
I wasn't surprised. Senator Isaacson has always been concerned about the institution of the Congress and whether or not certain processes are being followed. He has been more than willing on many occasions to step out and say that he disagreed with this policy or that policy of President Trump. But he also strongly believes that certain protocols, that certain processes need to be honored and recognized in order to maintain the integrity of the United States Congress.
Jim.
And he's concerned that what's going on in the House. Now, they still have time to do what we've been talking about. But up until this point, at least, he is concerned that certain protocols are not being followed, that endanger the long-term integrity.
Right. We're running out of time. I'm going to give you each a little.
Just very quickly. Keep in mind that one of the signers already before Isaacson was McConnell, and he and Isaacson very, very rarely separate themselves.
Okay.
The other part of that was what I'm told is that Isaacson wanted to made very sure first that this was about the process and not the substance of the accusation, because he was worried that he would be talking about something on which he might have to rule as a juror.
Lita, you got about 20 seconds to sum up your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it'll be very interesting to see how the pictures of David Perdue at the World Series game.
Oh, we didn't get to that.
Play out in the campaign.
Perdue was standing
right next
to the president.
To Trump as people were shouting, lock him up.
Lock him up. It was a very strange spectacle. It's interesting that there are Democrats who are saying this is not the way to treat a president of the United States, giving Trump a taste of his own medicine.
But I got to say, this is the city of the shutdown. And I would say maybe 3/4 of the people in that stadium were impacted by it.
All right. That's it. We talked right up to the limits of our time on this show. We'll be back again. Tomorrow, real quickly, Ariel Hart, who is the health reporter at the AJC, and Andy Miller, Georgia Health News. They're going to come in here and help us understand what the heck is Medicare for All really mean. What is universal coverage? We're going to drill down on health care with those two tomorrow. See you at 2:00.